Right.
So fine.
Okay, we resume our meeting and we're going to talk about emission trading schemes. I give the floor to Jane and then to Natasha.
Okay, thank you very much, Hans. Good morning, everybody. We now have two sessions that are being run by the same staff, so that does give us a little flexibility on time between the two as well. The first session, we're looking at emission trading schemes. This is a project that's only recently started up at the IESB, so we're very much in the research phase, and we're looking for input from the ASAF in order to help us develop a project plan for the IESB. So we're looking to identify what types of emission trading or similar emission reduction schemes exist, whether there's any existing accounting guidance on those schemes, and if not, what type of accounting would apply, so that we can help identify what topics or what issues the ISB ought to be considering within the scope of the project. With that, I'll hand over to Natasha to outline how we hope this session will run and how we can gather this input from you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you to you all who have responded to our survey, both members of the ASAF and your members of your jurisdiction. We sent out this survey asking you to identify the emissions trading schemes that are present in your jurisdictions, and if there was any accounting guidance that people could follow, and if not, what some common practices were. And we did get a good number of responses, and we've invited some of you to highlight the main points of those schemes today, just to get the discussion started. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with these types of schemes, there, just as a reminder, there is some background in papers 4B and 4C. As Jane said, we are in the early stages of this project, so we are mainly seeking input from you and from everyone about the types of schemes that are in existence and the types of accounting issues related to them that may arise. And we want this information so that we can consider what schemes should be in the scope of this project. So now we'd first like to invite Clement to talk to us about the AOSSG, some of the schemes in the AOSSG jurisdictions. And after Clement, Jiang Kiao will tell us about the schemes in China, and then Tomo for Japan, and Francoise for the EU. And then, of course, if any of the rest of you would like to jump in and tell us about some of your schemes, please feel free. This is just to start us off. So far.
Okay. Thank you, Natasha. I'm just going to focus on two of the jurisdictions in our region because the other who are having ETS will be around the table to talk about their own system. So the two that I'm going to talk about is the two jurisdictions that I'm talking about. One is Korea. Korea actually developed a low carbon green growth strategy in 2008, and in 2010, then all companies with large energy consumption must report their GHG emissions to under the so-called target management system TMS. And based on this system, it's actually a mandatory cap and trade system, which was introduced in that country and with voluntary opt-in. Since the introduction of that scheme, over 450 entities are covered by the system across the power industry, waste, and agricultural sector. And the ETS, subsequent to that, the ETS Act was passed in November 2012 for trading to commence on 1st January 2015. The same participants in the earlier system, in the TMS system, are expected to be covered in this ETS Act. And in general, I think the allocation of emission allowance is 100% free to the entities in the first compliance period, that is 2015 to 2017. And then 97% will become three in the second compliance period and further reduced to 90% in the third compliance period. So in that's the gist of the Korean system. And then the second jurisdiction will be New Zealand. The New Zealand ETS is a system in which New Zealand units are traded. And under this ETS, certain sectors are required to acquire and surrender the NZU, you know, the NZ units or other eligible emission units to account for their direct greenhouse gas emission or the emissions associated with their products. Basically, in this scheme, you know, there are three type of organizations or people involved. The first one is those who need to surrender and set you to the government. This is the case for the companies that mine natural gas. And the second category is those who need to earn who actually are earning NZU from the government. That is the owners of forests that absorb greenhouse gas. And then the third one are those industries which need to emit gas because of their commercial activities, but they cannot pass on to their customers. So the government, as a subsidies to help them to survive, actually will allocate NZU to them for free to start with. And once you know the NZU has been in the hands of the corporates, they can be freely to trade among themselves depending on the shortfall or the surplus they are having at the end of a certain compliance period. I think, you know, in a nutshell, you know, those two sort of jurisdictions are having the Korean more sort of clear-cut cap and tray. NZ tray, but whether it's allocated freely, not 100%. Some of them are earners, some of them need to buy it from the market. So it's kind of a hybrid, you know, for New Zealand. So basically, that's the two, you know, respective ETS scheme for Korea and New Zealand.
Thank you. Sorry, Clement, just any particular accounting issues in those that are highlighted? Obviously, the New Zealand scheme seems to be potentially more accounting issues because it is more of a mixed scheme with absorb. I don't know the right phrase for these, but you mentioned absorbers of the greenhouse gases, not just the emitters. So do you get a feel that we ought to be looking at those as well?
For the Korean one, they have their own domestic gap for that, the SKAS number 33. Actually, under that, they have two broad categories. One is the trader, and the other is the compliance accounts. And for under that gap, the assets is regarded as an intangible assets. And then depending on the compliance model or the trader model, then the measurement will be different. For the trader, it will be fair value. For compliance, it will be a cost, on cost model. And for the NZ one, I think when they, for the recipient that they got from the government, i.e., you know, the allocated one for free, to start off again, for NZ, they don't have a separate ETS accounting standard as such. They want the participants to follow IFRS. So for allocation of ETS from government, they follow the IAS 20. And then after subsequent measurement, it will be under 38 or 2, depending on the purpose of them holding those units.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
That's helpful.
Jim Kath, do you want to comment?
Yes, I would like to briefly introduce Chinese emissions trading scheme. China actually now has two sorts of emission trading schemes. One is the so-called CDM, a Clean Development Mechanism. The other is cap and trade schemes, which is very new for China. So I would like to briefly introduce both of them. First, relevant to the, with regard to the CDM, actually China has been involving CDM many years. Although China has no obligation to reduce the emission in according with Kyoto Protocol, because China is a developing country, but according to the Kyoto Protocol, for the developed countries, the companies from developed countries, they can buy the emission reduction certificates from developing countries if they through the CDM mechanism, the CDM. So China has been involving CDM many years. Currently, China has been the leading country in CDM. I got the number is that by 16 August 2013, China has registered 1,327 CDM projects in the United Nations, and has been certified emission reductions has been issued by the United Nations or has been verified by the United Nations equivalent to 3.74 billion CO2. So China has been currently is the biggest country who have CDM project and also has the biggest country who has the CERs. This is a CDM program. And the second is relevant to the cap and trade scheme. It is very new because Chinese government are now encouraging local government to try to establish cap and trade schemes. So currently there are only 7 provinces has started to do so in local level. By now, the trading volume, the total trading volume only 500 million RMB and equivalent to 13.75 tons of CO2. So it's just started. Most of them just started last year. So this is two scheme. But I just got news on my journey to London that the government are trying to combine of both them. The reason is that after the international financial crisis in 2008, China participated a lot of CDMs, but they cannot be sold the CR to the developed countries. So currently, there are a lot of CRs killed by the enterprises, but they cannot be realized. So China now encouraged the cap and the trade scheme because currently they started to operate to try to trade some of them, some of the CRs in the cap and the trade scheme, not only just a separate of CDM. So, but there are some limits. Different province has different regulation on them. Maybe 10%, maybe 20% to trade CRs. So I think currently it's encouraging that both markets are trying to combine. You know, with regard to the accounting treatment. First, with regard to the CDM, currently in Chinese accounting practice, it's quite simple. The companies has, you know, they are reduced emission, they has been verified by the United Nations. But the problem is that it's very difficult currently, very difficult to realize whether they can be received in cash or not. So there are a lot of uncertainties there. So currently, most of the companies, they just simply account for the revenue from CR when they receive the cash. So it's very simple. With regard to the cap and trade scheme, the accounting is still, I think currently, the companies participate in cap and trade scheme. Most of them actually adopted accounting treatments very similar to approach three, which we raised in the questionnaire. So it's quite simple, and it's cost based and very simple. So this is Chinese situation.
Thank you.
We have submitted the PowerPoint presentation, so I think everybody has this presentation slide. So let me go through the slide. But in the interest of time, I'd like to highlight the key points rather than going through all the slides. So please turn to the page 2. This is the sort of the development with regard to the Japanese emission trading schemes, as well as the accounting guidance with respect to the emission trading scheme. And one point I'd like to highlight is that back in 2009, we have revised the accounting guidance relating to the emission trading scheme. At that time, there was no mandatory trading scheme in Japan. And since then, we haven't revised the guidance. So the guidance we have in today is the based on the scheme, that is the voluntary basis, rather than mandatory trading scheme. So this is the point one. And point two is the page 3 and 4. There are basically two major trading scheme in Japan. One is the experimental emission trading scheme, which is a nationwide voluntary scheme. And the other one is the Tokyo Saitama Cap and Trade Program, that is the prefectural level mandatory scheme. So one is the voluntary basis, but it's nationwide. The other is the prefectural level, but it's mandatory. And and one point I'd like to highlight here is that we have a trading scheme emission trading scheme in both schemes, but it's very difficult to identify whether it's a cap and trade scheme or baseline and credit scheme, because it's a little bit sort of the hybrid nature. It's not a simple cap and trading scheme. It's not a simple baseline and credit scheme, but we have a sort of the hybrid nature of the and to prevent some shortcomings, etc. And the details are described in page 3 and 4. And third point is the accounting guidance that exists in Japan today. And page 6, we have highlighted some basic concepts, as well as there's some basic classification on emission credits. And basic concept is that we broadly classify the emission credit investment we broadly classify the entity's investment into two categories. One is the financial investment, the other is the business investment. The financial investment is the concept that the entity holds for the purpose of making profit from price changes, and there's a market in which the entity can sell the asset. And also, there's no restriction for an entity to sell the asset. So basically, the financial asset is that sort of the trading, the asset held for the trading purposes. And the other is the business investment, and which is not a financial investment. And based on the broad concept, we classify the emission credit into two categories. One is the held for sales, and the other is the held for an entity's own use. And depending on the classification, we provide the different accounting treatment, which is shown in page 7 and 8, but I think the page 9 and 10 will be more kind of visible. And as you see in the slide, page 9 and 10, our accounting guidance is broadly in line with the option 3 in the ISB staff paper, yet there is a difference because we classify the emission credit into two categories and provide a different accounting treatment depending on two categories. And therefore, in generally, our accounting treatment is in line with approach 3, but especially for the let's say the emission credit helpful cell, there is some difference, especially the subsequent measurement. So this is sort of highlight of our Japanese schemes as well as accounting guidance.
Thank you. Francois?
Yes, thank you. In fact, the European scheme is a cap and trade scheme that has a lot in common, in fact, with what has just been presented for Korea. This scheme has become effective in 2005 and involves now, up to 11,000 participants, which are electricity producers, energy intensive manufacturing units, or aviation operators. The scheme is organized around phases, and each phase corresponds to a particular objective of reduction. Right now, we are in the third phase that started in 2013 and lasts until 2020, with the objective of reducing, during that period, the level of the cap down from 80% to 30%. So it's already well advanced in its development towards allowing less and less free allowances and making emissions progressively onerous. And that's already the case, in fact, for all electricity producers. The allowances that are either allocated for free or being purchased are fungible within a particular time period, but basically there is now what is called a banking function that allows, in fact, transfers from one period to the next. For each time phase, the participants will know in advance how many allowances they will receive during the time period. However, the allocations are really made effective by calendar year. Everything is being managed now at European level. It started with a lot of involvement of the national authorities in the first time period. Now it's really managed at the European level. And it is, everything is dematerialized with a unique EU registry where every participant will hold an account, maybe two, because basically you have accounts for those who participate in the compliance program, but you have also the possibility of just joining as a trader. And so a lot of, in fact, financial intermediaries do that. But those who are in the compliance also hold trading accounts most of the time. And everything goes through this EU registry, in fact, the creation, the cancellations, the transfers, the allocations, and whether it's auctioning or purchasing on the market. So the market has been organized and, in fact, develops in majority around the use of derivatives, which are either net cash settled or are give rise to deliveries. So if you look at the scheme from the perspective of an operator, basically, through a calendar year, you have a full cycle of being allocated the allowances for the year, having to file, first of all, to monitor throughout the year your emissions, provide a report by the end of the year, which is verified independently, and which will determine how many allowances you have to surrender in the beginning of next year, and all this surrender act is being done in April. So everything evolves around a calendar year. If you fail to be in a position to surrender, if you don't have enough rights, you have to pay some penalties, and you still have to meet the obligation of surrendering the rights. So at a point in time, you can't escape from it. So that's for the scheme itself. In terms of accounting approaches, the survey that has been conducted basically reflects that at national GAAP level, member states may have developed some guidance that either is similar to approach 3 or approach 2, as described in the paper. And there is also evidence of a lot of practice in those who file IFRS accounts around approach 3 that has been voluntary impact selected as being the way to account for emission rights currently.
Thank you. Are there any?
It's just a question, because in major jurisdiction, there was a decision by the, I would like to know how usual that is, but there was a decision by the Securities and Exchange Commission a few years ago stating that those credits, as we call them, are not securities for the sake of regulation. And that was the main driver to call those intangibles. Because there was a discussion about maybe some people are arguing that you should consider them as a financial instrument, because you can actually sell them in the mid of the period. But then the commission said, well, this is not a security, I will not be involved with. Say, this is something else, and so far people don't know what it is. Is this a discussion that happened as well?
I think some people do think that they are financial assets. I don't know about any other jurisdictions where it sounds like you're not allowed to.
Yeah, they said that this is not a security, so should not treat this. But that decision was a regulatory decision. That's not to do with accounting.
Right.
But accountants look at this decision and said, well, this must consequently should be intangible. So.
It's an interesting point, and I'm looking to the European members around here, because I think if I remember rightly, in some of our initial research, the emission allowances, the credits or certificates, there's lots of different names for them, but I think the actual trading of them is covered by the regulation that does cover financial instrument trading. But again, that doesn't necessarily flow to the accounting for them. But I just think in terms of the control of them, they might be covered by the same legislation that covers the trading of financial instruments.
It's covered, I mean, in Europe it's covered by the what's called the MiFID.
So it is,
but that's for all the trading activities.
Does MiFID also cover commodities? So non-financial instruments for which there's an exit market? So
in some senses it is covered by.
But financial instruments aren't just securities.
But that's an important point to come back to the auditors in Brazil. Say, well, maybe you should come back and look at those financial instruments, despite the fact that the commission said that I would not are not deal with.
Anna?
Yes. A European country, we fall under the cap and trade scheme that was explained by Francois. And just from an accounting point of view, we issued a standard in 2006 that was quite similar to IFRIC 3. It was withdrawn. And this standard is still apply it. So if an entity acquires emission rights to and applies them to its activity, they are counted as intangible assets. If they are acquired for free, the entity accounts for a government grant. If the entity acquires the emission rights just for the purpose of trading, they are accounted as inventories. And if an entity holds a contract to buy or sell emission rights in the future, they are accounted under the standard for financial instruments. This is in general terms. We have the standard. Maybe we can talk, and I can give it to you and some more detail.
Can I just ask one question on the forward contracts and similar things? If they're financial instruments, do people take the own use exemption from IS 39 or IFRS 9 to say that if they are derivatives but they're on the allowances, that they will need to get back in order to remit mm-hmm. to the government?
Yes.
Do they take that exemption? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mary?
One characteristic that I didn't hear covered in the overviews that I think might be important for us to understand is whether or not grants of allowances, regardless of the scheme, have a condition of requiring to operate or not. I mean, in some of the early days of the schemes, there was some talk that some schemes were absolute grants. It might only be for a year because, in part, governments were looking for an economic subsidy to close down the most polluting plants, facilities, etc., and granting tradable rights that could then be sold if you decided to close was seen as a way of providing market incentive. And I think that might be important. Something that struck me, Francoise, and what you were saying is in terms of being in the third, I think you said third phase, is that might be a feature of one phase, but not all phases. So I just think that's information that we might want to think about collecting in terms of understanding features of the scheme, and I could see it potentially affecting the accounting for such a scheme.
Well, in the European scheme, if you, you are allocated the allowances every calendar year, as I explained, and if you report that you have decreased your capacity or closed down your unit, you do not have to surrender the allowances that you received, but you don't receive, they stopped the year after. So there is a form of limited subsidy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thomas, presentation and clarification question. On your slide 9, in Japan, you do not make any journal entry when you are at the beginning of this emission trading scheme. But in the case of IAS, the paper, the approach is 3, we are recognizing assets and liabilities, but the amounts become near. That's why we don't. But still, we recognize assets and liabilities. But in your case, you said you do not recognize anything at all at the beginning of the scheme. So could you explain what justification you have not recognizing any assets and liabilities?
Thank you, Janu, for your question. And well, at the first set, I think the outcome is the same. Under the approach 3 of the ISB staff paper, the asset liability wouldn't be recognized at the day one, and which is consistent with the Japanese approach. And the question is whether we intentionally didn't think that asset liability would be recognized, but should be networked, or even the right and obligation would be shouldn't arise from the net. From the emission trading scheme. I think that the latter thinking is based on the thought that the asset right and obligation should be looked at in combination rather than seeing as separately. And in the ASPJ accounting guidance, at that time or moment, we didn't provide the basis for conclusions, and so the basis for conclusion regarding why we didn't think the asset liability should be recognized at day one is a little bit unclear. And actually, in my understanding, I think at least the net asset liabilities or the net I think there are two ways to think, but regardless which view to take, asset liability shouldn't be recognized, and so the conclusion is that asset liability shouldn't be recognized. And I don't have a clear answer at this time or moment whether we should look at the right and obligation all together, or should look at asset liability separately, but present them on a net basis. So I apologize, my explanation not being very clear, but this is the background.
I think when we started to debate this roughly about 10 years ago, we debated a lot about the subsidy in the vouchers. And we didn't really look at what to do with the liability. We looked at what would happen in the income statement because of being granted these rights or whatever. Now that we have more and more rights that have to be bought, we slowly seem to be focusing more on the liability side, and to not book a liability for compliance is something which some people seem to be very easygoing with, whereas I, maybe with a German background, would be very hesitant not to think about the liability for the compliance. If in the end you come up with a net presentation, that's a different matter. However, as soon as you book the assets and liabilities, of course you are into the mechanisms of remeasuring. And the remeasurement of the liability is something which I think needs to be really thought about, because as long as you don't have the liability on your books, you are a bit more at ease in not thinking about the remeasurement of the liability, and you might get out of sync and you might have overall liability, and this is waived a bit too easily, I think.
Chris?
I would certainly echo those concerns, but I was actually just going to share, for a little bit of light relief, what the Australian scheme is, which is completely different to everybody else's.
Did you just abolish it?
Yes. We have something else. So we have just ditched the carbon tax, but we've now moved to something that's called an emission reduction fund, which I think is a variation on your results-based financing. So basically, the government's just put together a pool of funds which they're going to use as an incentive to give out to various emitters. And the way they're going to do that is, if you're an emitter and you have a scheme that's going to actually abate your carbon, then what you'll do is you'll put in a bid to the government to say, I really want some money from you, and the government will then decide whether or not they're actually going to give you any money. If they do, it's a fixed price that you know that you'll get. And what then happens is, as you go through the abatement process, you'll be issued with carbon credit units, and you then redeem those units to the government to get the cash back at that time. So it will be a slightly different approach to what everyone else is going through. From an accounting perspective, I think the key issues at this point are when you would actually recognise those assets that you would have as an emitter, and whether or not it would actually be a financial asset or whether it would still be an intangible asset. So that's what we're looking at this point.
Can I just ask, Chris, who pays into the fund? Is it the emitters themselves?
No, it's the government. Well, yeah, ultimately, it's we as the taxpayers.
So it comes out of the general tax.
Government fund, yeah.
Thank you.
Sounds very political. Rebecca?
From a Canadian perspective, We have both a cap and trade and also a carbon tax that's coming into play, but I think what's a little interesting is our cap and trade scheme is based on the Western Climate Initiative, and within our each of our provinces they've actually set different limits as from an emissions standpoint when in essence participation is required, but it also can be voluntary. So clearly there are different approaches, and understanding I think the specifics of each of the schemes is going to be very important. What I kind of was wanting to kind of emphasize, though, is when we're starting to look at this, and I guess this is the first step, and it's important that we all have an understanding of what those different schemes are and what the accounting is. I think what in Canada we're seeing a more common approach would be approach three, but also approach one is in use. And I think it really does vary as well on the life stage. So as we move forward, considering not just from what the characteristics are and what those commonality of the different mechanisms is, that we start to also assess what the economic purpose is, because in effect in the long term one of the driving factors will be is that this could be an additional cost for companies unless they've actually undertaken efforts to remediate. So maybe keeping that kind of standing back and considering that broader perspective is going to be important. But as many people have mentioned, and the question has been evolving, circling about, is it an element or not? I think it's going to be important in the next steps for this research is that we do start to integrate this work and thinking with the conceptual framework. And one of the comments we had in doing our consulting was that infamous unit of account. Is it the allowance? Is it the activity of that organization? Or is it at the entity level? Because that can change your kind of approach of how you might think about it, which I think we saw in the rationale in the papers of the different approaches being used today. So we just wanted to support the ongoing work.
Thank you, Rebecca. Perhaps at this point, I appreciate, Tom, you're waiting, but the unit of account, certainly the different approaches that are most commonly seen somehow manage to work out that when you get to the bottom line, it tries to take a net position, which picks up on I think all of the speakers that have said it really tries to either just go straight to a net position and only recognize typically it's a liability for the extra emissions that have been made that you don't have enough allowances to cover. It's the most common situation. Or it recognises assets and liabilities but tries to match up the accounting treatment so that the bottom line number is still the same. So I think the unit of account is absolutely crucial, and if anybody has any ideas for pushing that forward, we'd be happy to hear.
And it could be unit of presentation or account, because you could treat the two things separately but then present them as one, or you could say the scheme itself is the thing we're accounting for that could go in or out of the money. So there are different ways to think about this, and it's, you know, it's... We have this in a couple of other areas as well, obviously in terms of, in terms of our thinking, you think about the scheme itself, whether that gives you a liability. So you're obliged to return some credits at the end, or some of these credits. Is that just a measurement issue, or is it actually whether you've got an obligation or not? And we have, in similar issues, we have in even something as simple as leases, where you've got contingent rentals based on future performance. Have you got a liability that you're just measuring, or is it there no liability at all? So it's not isolated to this project, and we've got to make sure we think about that across the whole spectrum of accounting, because you make a decision in this particular project, it can spill over into other areas as well. So Rebecca's right about particularly the framework trying to help us sort that out, both the appropriate unit plus what a liability is.
Tom?
Given the CO2 emissions in the United States, it's a little disappointing, and I have to report there is no program in the United States and no accounting necessary as a result. But
well, you hardly use any energy at all. So
that was the point I started with. But more importantly, I was a board member when we first started this journey jointly, and many people here are not. And I think a very important point to beginning to think about is what Liesl started. I mean, most of what people were talking about are the asset side, but it is the liability. I think that's the most challenging here. And how do you think about when a liability ought to be recognized? Is it emitting that causes the liability? That's quite easily a way of thinking about it. But in a real sense, another way that we were working on it and thinking about it is the obligating event. What is the obligating event that causes the liability? And some of your conceptual framework discussion at the ISB has been about conditional or unconditional, those sorts of things. And I don't think that the liability here has anything to do about conditionality as much as whether or not there's been an obligating event that creates a constructive obligation or not. In some of the conversation I think the board's had, maybe decided with unit of account or unit of presentation, but was more along the lines that the being subject to the program may be the obligating event. You certainly are worse off when the government puts in the program. And is that cause the obligating event immediately that begins to talk about thinking about recognizing the liability at the start of the period in which you receive the credits, if it's a cap and trade scheme. But I just encourage you to begin thinking about obligating event very carefully, and to echo Liesl's point of view, it's the liability that's the challenge here, not so much the asset.
Roger?
I didn't really want to speak because it seemed we were mainly dealing about the facts of various schemes rather than getting into a technical debate, but just one comment. I do agree also with Liesl that liability is important, but I wonder whether we can solve this. If that's the case, can we solve this before we've solved provisions? Because if you talk about the obligating event and then you go back to levies, you know, then the obligating event there is the government decides to impose a levy scheme. But then we're into these bizarre situations where you might not be a bank at the year end, or you might not be a utility by the year end, therefore that we can't provide. So once you start focusing on the liability, then I think we have to first have to solve provisions, in which case should we do that first?
And is this different from a tax? And you have to earn income to be able to have a tax.
Yeah.
A lot of connections.
Yeah.
I like your word, soul.
Just for clarity, the IFRIC interpretation on levies number 21 does have a scope exception for emission trading schemes, which is how we get out of that particular predicament in the short term. So
it's not a long-term solution. But it is a reasonable interpretation of the basic standards.
Yes.
And so
yeah, absolutely.
We'd end up here with a different answer potentially than that standard.
Yeah. Certainly the existing treatments that are going round wouldn't fit within the provision standard or the levies interpretation, but again, that's because it's specifically excluded.
Tomo?
Yeah. Unit of account is the very, very difficult subject, and it's very difficult to answer, but at least let me share some of the discussion we had amongst ASBJ's members. Well, as I said earlier, we don't have a different view at this time or moment. How we should look at unit of account for this emission trading schemes. But nevertheless, there's one view that because the right and obligations are so interrelated, and therefore it's more natural or it's more appropriate to look at the net asset, net right and obligation altogether. And this is some members' view, and including myself. The other view is that, well, the right and obligation should be separately recognized, but in the presentation, on the basis of the presentation unit, we can't look at the different way. The difficulty on the latter path is that we should modify some of the principles in the measurement basis or measurement basis. And because if we look at the unit of account separately, but prefer net presentation, and in subsequent
Sorry, we were off.
Okay. The question is whether we should apply the very unique accounting model similar to the mirroring approach that the insurance contract project previously adopted. And so depending on which approach we should take, there are some difficult issues, and we really think that it should be considered in the context of the conceptual framework project. But nevertheless, I'd like to raise the other issue, which is the nature of business activities conducted. As I said earlier, in the SPGA's accounting guidance, there are two approaches, accounting approach in the emission-related scheme. And I think, broadly speaking, the different accounting treatment are based on the nature of the business conducted. And ISP, the conceptual framework, tended to be decided that the nature of business activity is a very important consideration for measurement. And so, so I'd like to emphasize that unit of account is very important, but also the nature of business activities conducted will be very important consideration in proceeding this project.
So we had a first discussion in preparation for this meeting in the Forum of Standard Setters. It's not the first discussion that we have on the subject in EFRAG. Of course, we had at the time discussed IFRIC 3, and also much more recently, we had some proactive work on the subject. But let me concentrate basically on what we gathered as a preliminary input in the meeting we held last week. There was an acknowledgement that divergent practices have developed, and even though that was a case, there was a form of a reluctance to seeing a lot of standard setting effort being made, and that was just not natural. Divergent practices would call for an accounting requirement that eliminate them. So we went a bit further, because we were a group of standard setters, we accepted that divergent practices had to be remedied. And basically, the reluctance that was first felt comes from the feeling that in trying to solve this issue, if you adopt a very conceptually based approach, there is a fear that you may not get to what is the most useful, the most understandable, or that you may bring complexity that could be best avoided. So basically, I think the first recommendation from the group, and there was a lot of consensus around the table, was to say, well, first define the information that is needed, and in a way start from there to get to the right answer. And some indications were given of how you would get to a good answer. There wouldn't be any form of day one gain, because all this is about introducing new costs. So you cannot be richer just because you have to pay more. The cost, because it is indeed a cost, should be spread and reflected in the accounts in a reasonable manner, as the cost is accrued, so as the emissions are incurred. And basically, when you have that, you just analyze your certain liabilities that you have to recognize to get there. So it's totally almost counterintuitive for standard setters to say, well, that's the outcome. Now, let's define what leads us there. But I think it's a good recommendation not to get into fuzzy accounting treatments that would not, in fact, suggest a lot of acceptance. And as Liesl has put it, it is important that this liability that is accruing over time is not ignored and is best reflected. I think we have to have in mind that the net liability approach has developed and is not really doing that. So there will be a lot of reluctance in moving out of this practice that has developed. I think the only way to get people to agree to eliminate the divergent practices and basically to move away from this net liability approach is indeed to get to something that is fully understandable, simple, and that they can accept.
To get away from the net liability, you said?
Yes. So from?
To get to or away from?
Away from. Because basically the cost, you incur the cost as you emit. And if you do not recognize it, you're just getting into the situation that
you. So you wouldn't do anything on the balance sheet or gross asset and liability presentation?
We have not gotten there. But I think if we say that the cost has to be recognized so that users have a good understanding of how the cost of production, in fact, is subject to that supplementary cost of the air is no longer free, you, by definition, will build a liability over time. But your liability is not there before you have emitted. But it cannot be delayed after you have emitted, basically. I mean, we have not formulated all this in that manner, but I think it's basically what was said around the table is leading
but
to.
But the asset is there before you have emitted. You get this grant of rights.
Unless you have to buy them.
And I think you would, if you put that on the balance sheet, you would also have to make an estimation of the liability you're going to incur in the same period.
That's your day one profit.
If you put it on
well,
a fair value.
It could be a day one loss. Yeah.
And that's why, you know, the thing, recognize the cost as it is incurred, so build up the liability, no day one profit, and probably you recognize the assets and liability that you have to recognize. You have also to take into account that there is this business model of trading that needs to have its proper accounting treatment, but it's not the one that is really creating the most difficulties. And maybe you will be, in the process of recycling the mirroring approach that has not been successful in insurance. You have a lot of ways which are not necessarily what a purely conceptual approach would lead to that would get the right answer, a good answer.
Rebecca?
Well, having just reflected on the conversation, I kind of support Francoise. What I was realizing we hadn't reflected on was what user needs were and what was that useful information that we are trying to provide and how best to do it in this circumstance. And from our from consulting several years ago with our user advisory council, there had been a focus on understanding when allowances are allocated, because a cost basis doesn't give them the ability to know if those allowances, the level changes in the future, or the entity doesn't qualify, what the effect is then on the future cash flows, assuming they're continuing to operate in that same manner. So I think we've given lots of food for thought and areas to explore next.
Okay, shall we move on?
Yes, thank you very much indeed for that, everybody. The next steps, obviously, is to try and consolidate all of these different views and thoughts and put it into a project plan for the ISB to think about. But I have no doubt at all we'll be coming back and seeking your input in lots of ways, both during these meetings and perhaps offline as well, to gather more information from the questionnaires that you submitted. So thank you very much indeed.
Contemplating the name, the emission trading scheme seems a bit narrow. Maybe emission management schemes or something like that might be a description, because it's cap and trade, for example. It all applies cap and trade schemes. So.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good point, Alan. Thank you for that, because there were one or two people mentioned about there are, we're not just talking about emitters, we are talking about traders as well, which I think we need to look at, even if we decide they're already covered by other standards. But there's the emitters, the participants in the scheme,
And also one or two people mentioned the absorbers of the emissions. So New Zealand is the forestry. China has got the, it's not necessarily absorbers, but the reducers of emissions that create these certified emission rights that can then be used elsewhere. So there's lots of variations. So I think Alan's suggestion, emission management schemes perhaps is a more encompassing title for the...
Yeah, I'd also caution about making sure we remember the business model, because different business models may end up with different accounting, and I don't think we should assume that everyone will be covered by one method of accounting.
Yeah.
Do you think at the end, Jane, given all the variety of schemes and you've just been there, that we can come to a common answer?
I'm one of life's eternal optimists, and I don't think we'll get to a common answer, but I would hope that we could identify enough principles that if the schemes are economically similar, we should end up with similar answers.
And there may not be just one. It may be that you deal with those schemes that have got both some sort of allowance in a sense, and then you've got the emission that goes with it.
Yeah.
As opposed to absorption schemes, for example, might be that you're actually being paid to do something or having to pay to do something. So a pay-as-you-go scheme can be completely different to one where you're essentially being given some rights for the next year, and you're naturally hedged in that if you keep the same level of activity, you've got enough rights to offset against the emissions. That's a different process. So it may not be just a single thing, but it's a little bit like, this is why we're dealing with the rate regulation in a second, there's probably not one rate regulation scheme in the world. There are several that have different characteristics. And trying to tease out of those the most common characteristics and account for those, there may be two or three different things that we have to have a look at.
Yeah. And I think, and Roger touched on the point about interactions with existing standards as well as the conceptual framework. We mentioned IAS 37 on provisions. We've mentioned IAS 38 on intangibles, 39 or IFRS 9 on financial instruments. Government grants was mentioned as well, IAS 20. Going back to Clement's comments about forestry in New Zealand, the treatment of government grants in agriculture is different than the general treatment of government grants. So we have IS 41 on agriculture as well. And it may depend on the appetite for trying to stick within those existing standards, or do we end up with something that sits apart and is a separate standard that deals with the interactions. And again, it goes back to the unit of account. If you look at each component separately, we probably do have an accounting standard that deals with it. But if you don't take the step back and look at the overall economics, as IFRIC 3 showed, it doesn't necessarily give you a sensible answer that faithfully represents the economics of the scheme. So.
And again, the spillover we've got to be careful of. If you have a scheme, for example, where you get compensated through some sort of credits for, say, not cutting down trees, then that sounds a lot like schemes where you're paid not to farm, for example, or you're paid to keep a wildlife strip on your farms, for example, as you have in the EU. So you've got to be very careful about putting something and calling it a mission scheme and having special accounting, which doesn't seem to tie in with other things.
Francoise, you mentioned divergence in practice. Is that divergence because the schemes are different, or divergence within similar schemes or the same scheme?
The scheme is European.
I mean, yeah. I mean, within Europe, there are divergent practices, and they are within the same scheme.
Yeah. Major or minor divergences?
I think, I mean, we don't have sufficient, I mean, to give you a proper answer, I would need to have gathered evidence that I don't have. So it's more, what we know is more from hearsay than just having measured examined annual reports. So I can't go beyond that.
It's 'cause my sense is that we have different mechanisms for getting down to a net position, and that you can use IAS 20, I think, to count for the credits coming in as an asset and a liability, and then feed those through as income to offset the liabilities that grow. So you deliver the credits back at the end. So there are lots of ways, but I think most people are probably thinking about this in net terms. but they're getting there in quite different ways. So the divergence may be the mechanics of getting there as opposed to the essential outcome. Because I haven't seen as much evidence of when people receive the credits that they're going basically debit asset credit income and then accruing a liability. They tend to be at ways of netting in a sense.
Well, Thomas has raised the issue of the unit of account, and you have also people who believe that nothing happens. You're not affected unless you are in a position where you don't have enough allowances to meet your obligation, and that nothing happens before. So,
and another justification for that is not so much that nothing happens, but you receive the allowances at zero cost. IS 20 allows you to recognise a government grant at a nominal amount, so people would say the nominal amount is zero, so I have recognised my asset, it just happens to be a measurement of zero, and then I will recognise a liability as I'm emitting, but actually that has no cost whilst I have allowances on hand. So again, my liability is at nil value until I exceed how many allowances I have on hand, and therefore that's when that cost starts to be measured. So some people say that's recognising nothing. Others will say, well, we are recognising, we're just doing it at nil amounts, so therefore we don't present it.
It's a bit of a worry you'd be relying on IS 20.
Oh, that's
it's broken standard.
Well, it's just flexible, Ian. It just allows you
to... It's the standard we have. It's all we've got.
Let's try to wrap this up.
No, just say that in my jurisdiction you see differences in practice, even for the same instrument. So some people try to fair value this, say that I can, well, it's a new amount on the first day, but then the next day I can try to evaluate this and how to amortize, so.
There is industry guidance, and at least the energy companies have come to a certain common understanding for quite a number of years, and then a national standard set of coming up with a standard broke off one country more or less.
Roger?
Just to say, I mean, there's lots of licenses around. The peculiarity of this is that you can trade, although you might not.
Yeah.
But at the start of the year, lots of companies can get a license to do something. That some of them can be traded, so you can end up with aircraft landing slots, for example, which are traded. But I don't think people start thinking about capitalising them. And we're dealing with companies, normal business operations, which traditionally we deal with at cost. So it's only that it's a quasi, well, some people think, not me, that it's a quasi financial instrument, which suddenly means we have to start valuing the thing at fair value, and does that value go up and down, or does the liability go up and down? And I worry we can overcomplicate something when, as Francois said, what you really have here is at the end of the year, you're probably going to have to pay something, and yet we go on a very complicated journey through the year on the way to get there, and the simple.
Although I think the hope of the government, in this case Europe, is that companies will look at it from a fair value perspective, and that they will make an estimation of how much they will be using, how much they will have to purchase, or how much they can save, so that they can sell some of these rights. So the whole idea is that. Give a market incentive based on the fair value of the rights to cut down your emissions. Okay.
Thank you very much.